Your next promotion is just the beginning, and this podcast shows you how to get there. Welcome to episode number 190. Today's episode is dedicated to my incredible client, Sherry. Sherry's husband passed away suddenly a couple of months ago, and she refers to her husband, Fred, as a smart, funny, and most importantly, sweet and loving soul. I never had the opportunity to meet Fred personally, but I am very familiar with his wife and her leadership and guidance and compassion and mentorship and just all around an absolutely incredible woman. And I connected with Krista St. Germain, the host of the Widowed Mothers podcast. And I wanted to have her on for today's episode to share with us some ways that we can work with our colleagues and leaders at our organization when they are dealing with times of grief so that we can truly be a supporter and an ally for them, but also not hold them back unconsciously. And today's episode also gives really incredible insight. If you are someone who has suffered a loss of any kind, you're going to gain really valuable tools and insights. So I encourage you to listen to this episode in the entirety and to share it with a colleague or a friend in need, because we never know what someone is going through inside unless we ask. Thank you, Sherry, for your bravery, your courage, and for showing up as a corporate badass, even in the face of adversity. I love you so much, and I hope everyone benefits from this episode. Welcome to Women Changing Leadership. I am your host, Stacey Mayer, and I teach you how to get promoted, get paid, and bring your whole self to the leadership table. I am on a mission to change organizations from the C-suite out, because women are the new face of leadership, and we are doing it on our terms. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Women Changing Leadership. I am your host, Stacey Mayer, and super excited, as always, to be here with you again this week. So I will have you know, I am genuinely excited about today's conversation, even though it is a very dark, traditionally dark topic. And this is not actually the reason I'm excited about it, but something that you should know about me, if you don't already know this, is that I obviously have a performing background, which I'm sure many of my listeners know that, but they might not know that I wrote a one-woman show called The Funeral Logs that I toured around New York and the world. And it was a comedy about funerals. And basically what I did with this show is I wanted to provide a space for people to speak openly about grief and death and situations that had happened for them. And I'm looking at my guest today, Krista, and she looks very happy that I did this, right? And I have a feeling that she and I are kindred spirits in that way of not shying away from the tough topics, but also being willing to hold space for challenging conversations and otherwise taboo subjects that, especially in the workplace, you might feel like you shouldn't bring up or talk about. And so when I received an outreach from Krista's publisher, I had actually experienced from my client's side a couple of very big losses. And each one of these women who are executive leaders dealt with their loss in very unique ways. Some of them leaned into their work. Some of them pulled away from their work. Some of them went on sabbatical. There were all different myriad of ways. Some of them wanted to be around people. Some of them didn't want to be around people. But the common theme was providing space on this podcast to have this conversation. What if you are an executive leader and you personally experience grief? What if you are an executive leader and you have someone on your team who experiences grief? So that is why I said yes almost immediately within 5 minutes of getting the email to Krista's person and said, yes, please, I need her on my podcast. And I'm again, I keep using the word excited, but I really genuinely am. I feel very blessed that we can have this conversation today. And so thank you as the listener as well for listening and being a part of this conversation. Thank you, Krista.
I'm so excited. I'm really glad you didn't tell me that before you hit record. I know we're going to have a powerful discussion. Excited to be here.
Let me tell you a little more about Krista and her expertise. Krista St. Germain is a master certified life coach, post-traumatic growth and grief expert, widow, mom, and host of the Widowed Mom podcast. When her husband was killed by a drunk driver in 2016, Krista's life was completely and unexpectedly flipped upside down. After therapy helped her uncurl from the fetal position, Krista discovered life coaching, post-traumatic growth, and learned the tools she needed to move forward and create a future she could get excited about. Now she coaches and teaches other widows so that they can love life again too. Krista, thank you so much.
Truly, I love it when anyone wants to talk about grief because I was so unprepared for my own grief experience that if we can have conversations that help people become more prepared for grief because it is going to happen to them, then I am all in, right?
Yeah. You know, I used to feel a bit of imposter syndrome because when I wrote the show, I hadn't experienced a large amount of grief in my life. You know, I was like, I have both parents. I actually still had grandparents. I had all my siblings. And I did kind of grapple with that and wonder, why have I been called to open the door and hold space for this conversation when I didn't have firsthand experience? But what I did have was the ability to kind of, just as I said, is engage in tough conversations, engage and allow other people to share and to listen. And I don't know, I didn't really expect to have this be my first topic in this conversation today, but I wonder if there might be something to that as a leader, that even if you don't know what it's like to lose a spouse, how do we engage in conversation with somebody who just did? Like, you know, where do we start, right? And I think that's part of what holds us back, is that looking back, if I had said, oh, I can't do the show because I've never experienced a loss myself, I mean, that just seems absurd because I felt called to do that. I felt called to ask. I felt called to reach out.
Yeah, but I don't think it's uncommon for people to be uncomfortable and be in that position and tell themselves, well, you know, I haven't been through it, therefore I can't support or worry about saying the wrong thing. You know,
I think that's really common.
Even I did that to myself a little bit before I decided to become a coach for widows, because I told myself, well, you know, it was my second marriage and I hadn't been married as long as other people. And somehow, you know, I discounted my own experience. So I think it's pretty human of us to kind of discount what we have been through, compare it to someone else, and then decide that because it's different, it means we aren't capable.
Right. And so then, how do we engage in conversation with somebody or reach out, you know, because I think a lot of us have that desire. This I actually got from Sheryl Sandberg's second book, when she lost her husband, and she talks about how the worst question that you can ask is, let me know if you need anything. And so, you know, and I think that that's our inclination, is to reach out, but then we sort of continue to put the burden on the person who is experiencing the grief to tell us what they need. And so in terms of your recommendations for how people can connect, how people can reach out, and I suppose there's no right or wrong way. I suppose if you say, let me know if I can do anything, there's nothing wrong with that. But I do try and challenge myself to ask something that is a little bit, you know, actually going to allow the grieving person to accept help.
Yeah. And if you can go into it knowing that you're probably going to say something that later you kind of wish you hadn't, you can give yourself grace. You can give the other person grace. That will help a lot. And also, I think the most important thing is to go into it knowing that how that other person feels is not a problem, and especially not a problem for you to solve.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Because what I got told, and what a lot of the women I work with have been told, are things that come from people who mean well, but who are really kind of, without knowing it, trying to solve someone else's emotional state. So they will say things like, you know, don't worry, they're in a better place. or at least they're no longer suffering. It's, you know, kind of those plateaus, cliches, silver lining thoughts, or, you know, for me, it was don't worry, you're young, you'll find someone else. And we only say those things because we don't know how to be comfortable when someone else is uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And so we try to get them to feel better because that's kind of the only way we know to feel better. So if you know that going in, and you know that how they feel isn't a problem, and it certainly isn't a problem for you to solve, then we can look at it differently. And we can notice that really what our goal is just to be with the person, be a witness to what's happening to them. We're not trying to change how they feel because it's not a problem that they feel that way. That's just however they're responding to grief is their response. So I love you. This sucks, right? Like,
yeah,
I'm with you. And then we can go into it in a space where we're really holding space for however they feel. And we're not asking them to tell us how to make them feel better. We're not trying to make them change. We're not trying to get them to please us or hide from us how they actually feel because they want us to feel better. We can just be in their presence authentically and genuinely. And so there's no script for that.
Right. Right.
But if you know that's the idea, is grief doesn't mean somebody's, you know, needs to be fixed here. They're not broken. They're just grieving. I'm just going to be with them and witness what it is. Mm-hmm. And those, when I look back on my own experience, the people who were able to do that for me were the people that I'm just so grateful for.
Yeah.
You know, just the ones that would say, hey, do you just want to grab a cup of coffee and just be, you know, just be with me. Mm-hmm. Just want to go to the bookstore.
Yeah.
You know, not how are you really doing? You know?
Yeah, like, I know what you mean.
You're so strong.
Yeah, exactly. So what did pull you up off the floor? What was the big turning point for you personally, where you were able to kind of get back up and make a shift?
You know, I think it came in phases. So in the beginning, I was pretty numb and it felt like a terrible nightmare that I had gone through and I was probably going to wake up from, but also I had young children, right? I had a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lot easier to get out of bed when you know that you have people who are depending on you. So, so that kind of kept me in motion. And then thankfully I had a great therapist who I went back to. She had helped me a few years before and I went immediately back to her, and I loved my time with her because it really allowed me the opportunity to talk about what had happened at a time when it felt so unreal. Just talking about it, telling it without worrying about how it was going to be received and without worrying about how, you know, the other person felt about it, until I could get to a place where my brain actually caught up with my new reality, right?
And yeah.
It no longer felt like he was on a business trip. And so, you know, that was probably by about 6 weeks for me, not that there's any timelines or anything, but that's about the point where I was like, okay, I can function again. I'm going to go back to work now. Mm-hmm. He and I had worked together at the same company. So I actually kind of looked forward to going back to work because people there, some of them had known him for longer than me, you know, and they missed him too. And so it was a good environment for me to go back to because it was loving, and everyone, not only did they have great compassion for me, but they understood the loss because they felt it. And then I reached this place, which I didn't have language for it then, but now I call it a grief plateau. This is where a lot of people end up and they really don't know where they are, but you're kind of past acute grief. You're back to functioning. If you wanted to go back to work, you could. You're not in bed all day crying. You're not in the fetal position anymore. Mm-hmm. People are telling you how strong you are. And you kind of understand why they're telling you that, because you are getting things done, you know? Mm-hmm. And also, you don't feel strong. You don't feel good. You feel empty and hollow and robotic. And my belief that I didn't really want to articulate was that my best days were probably behind me. I didn't really want to say that out loud, but that's really what I thought was, okay, I'm going to make it. I'm going to survive.
Yeah.
But like, I should probably just be happy for what I had, because I don't think that's going to happen again. And that was that plateau where you just kind of start to settle without even knowing that you're doing it, because it feels like your new reality. And, and people use that term new normal, you know? And sometimes I think that's what we think that is new normal. Like, I'm resigning myself to something that's less than what I actually want because of what's happened.
I was just thinking about it in my work in particular. We're talking about career advancement. And so if somebody comes into my world, it is because they're trying to go to a next level of something, right? So whether it's to get a promotion or it's just more inclusion or more opportunity, like there's something about it. And I think that when you think about grief, hypothetically, and then probably for the person who's actually experiencing it, it's like, I can imagine that place of, well, you know, that was nice then, that goal was nice then, but I need to give up on that as well.
Yeah.
And knowing your bio and how it turned out in the end, it seems like you got off that plateau or shifted that plateau or changed that plateau, whatever.
Yeah.
That process was for you, but I can definitely see the parallels once. I mean, even if somebody in our lives is sick or like just a life situation, oh my goodness, maternity leave. That's like a whole thing for women. They're like, well, you know, my career goals were all great before kids, but now I have to change them. Right. So there's different reasons why we come up against that, but I'm curious from you. So what was that next phase where you sort of said, this doesn't have to be my new normal?
Yeah. So first, I just want to say that I'm so glad you just brought in maternity and other things, because sometimes people assume that grief only means something that happens when someone dies, right? And that is the context in which I am most frequently speaking about it, because I work with widowed moms. But grief is really the natural human response to any perceived loss.
Yes.
So you thought, you know, having a baby was going to be one particular way with your career, and then it isn't. Like, that's still grief. So I'm really glad, you know, that you said that.
Good. Thank you for making that connection too.
Yeah, for sure. So what helped me, it was this very weird chain of events. My therapist was actually, let me back up. So something big enough like that can kind of make one step back and go, wait a minute, if life is this short, is this what I want to be doing with my life? And that's what happened to me, where I went, I don't really love aviation, but that's what I was in a project manager and an engineering team. And I didn't love aviation. My late husband had a big passion. He was an avionics engineer, electrical engineer. So I went, I don't think this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And my therapist said, you should become a therapist. I'll help you. I'll get you into an MFT program. You can, when you're done, you can come work for me. And then she had it all planned out, right?
Wow.
It's like, oh, okay. Well, you know, I kind of am that person that people come to, and that is something that's been very helpful to me. So I really will start considering that. So I applied. I had one class that I needed to take that I didn't have in my undergraduate. So I started taking this class. And at the same time, I enrolled in a life coaching program. Not knowing much about life coaching, but having listened to a podcast that was particularly helpful for me, I enrolled in that. And so I'm doing both at the same time. It wasn't but 6 months of that coaching program, and I started to learn that my best days are behind me wasn't actually factual, right? I started to learn that that was a story in my brain, and that I was a boss of the stories that I told myself. And that if I didn't like that story and it wasn't moving me towards what I wanted, I could actually change that story. Before that coaching program, it had never occurred to me that that was just a story in my brain. I really believed that was the reality of my situation, not knowing how the brain worked and how I could change thoughts and the power of doing so. And so that 6 months in the coaching program kind of made it very clear to me that while therapy had been really useful to me, what was moving the needle the most and what I was feeling like was the answer that I had never had before was coaching. So I ditched the MFT program before it even started. I got accepted and then I was like, just kidding, I'm out. And then I pursued coaching. At that point, not thinking I was going to help widows, honestly, I still thought I would be too sad. So that came later. But I just decided, you know, life is short. I want to do something that's powerful. This is what's really helping me. And a lot of people don't know about it. So that's what I want to do. So I certified, quit my job, and became a coach.
Oh, I love that. Thank you. I was thinking a little bit more about what we talked about before, which is this place of advice giving and feeling inclined to fix people and get them out of it. And One of the places that I've really tried to be in with my clients is allowing, you know, definitely holding space, being there for them, but then allowing them to do whichever direction they want to, right? Yeah. If they're like, oh, I want to lean into work, then I will be available for that. I want to lean into something else, something new, whatever pivot, whatever that might be for them. But this idea of self-care comes to mind. And I know you talk about self-care. So that's why I want to hear your perspective on this. Because when I just hear self-care, it has a shaming element to it, especially when it comes to grief. So I could see a woman in an executive leadership position and every leader being like, you need self-care. Like, right, mm-hmm. We're going to give you space. We're going to let you stay home. You're going to take that time you need. Don't do this project. You need space, right? And so then self-care actually becomes a weapon against them, right? So then they're not being put up for a promotion opportunity because somebody else thinks that they need to take care of themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious what your take on self-care really is and how we can use it in our own unique way to both take care of ourselves, but then also being willing to be perhaps okay and to be okay going back to work and to be okay engaging in really tough problems at work as well.
Yeah. So I find that people tend to think of self-care as like bubble baths and pedicures, but as it relates to grief, often what they think is they have to do kind of the quote unquote work of grief. Like they have to spend lots of time journaling and they have to mm-hmm. spend time, you know, feeling their feelings and doing all of the loss related activities. So what I think is really valuable is the dual process theory of grief. I don't know if you're familiar with that one. First of all, there's a lot of theories of grief. People seem to only know the five stages, but the dual process theory is one of my favorites. And it's particularly useful in this context. So basically what it says is that if we take activities and we divide them up into two buckets, we have grief-related or loss-related activities. So that would be thinking about the loss, dealing with the logistics of the loss, you know, feeling your feelings, journaling, loss-related things. Then another bucket is restorative or non-loss related mm-hmm. activities. So that yeah. means doing anything but. That could be mm-hmm. working. Right? That mm-hmm. could be a Netflix binge. That could be mm-hmm. gardening. That could be time with friends or things that. So sometimes because we have this black and white thinking and we think, well, I should take care of myself, we tend to only want to spend time in the one bucket of grief-related, right. loss-related activities. But what dual process theory teaches is that actually the healing is found in the intentional oscillation back and forth between yes. both buckets, right?
So that I was just thinking about the other bucket too, which is the same, right? Which is the reason that we advise self-care is because so many people go back into their work and they're not leaving time for the other bucket to deal yes. with the grief-related activity. So it goes like, it's really the opposite of going for one bucket or the other.
It's right. It's allowing yourself to go back and forth. And there's mm-hmm. there's no particular rhythm that you have to find or particular ratio that you need to do it in. But it's, I think people get this idea that it's somehow wrong to work or to find distraction. But really, it's actually quite helpful. But we just want to do it consciously. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're finding yourself in a position where you are working so hard and so fast and you never slow down. And you kind of know that if you allow yourself to do that, that you feel like you're going to fall in a black hole and you're never going to mm-hmm. come out.
Right.
That we probably want to take a look at, right? Is like, why is it so scary? And how can we create a little more space to look at what actually happened? But like, let's get rid of the shoulds and shouldn'ts about, well, I should do only grief-related things or I should never distract. And let's find the healthy oscillation back and forth, back and forth.
Oh, that's so good. Permission. I love that. And, you know, and one of my clients, what I was talking to her about was instead of feeling like you need to reassure everyone at work that you're okay, that you can come back, you know, where we start to use language like I'm doing better, right? Even if that's not true. What I offered to her, and I'd love your take on this as well, it seemed to help, was to assure them that you will let them know what you need, right? Yeah. That you will communicate your needs. And so if that day means that that needs to be the day where you're in a different, the grieving bucket, where you are taking the self time for yourself and journaling and spending space and crying and whatever that might be, then that's what you'll do that day. And if it seems like I want to work today and that's bringing me joy and fulfilling, life fulfilling, then that's what I will do that day. And I will be here and I will be present and I'm with you. Right. And so, yeah. So then that kind of keeps us out of that space of apologizing unnecessarily for either our tears or our grief, or saying, no, I'm fine. And instead just being like, I will communicate with you. I will talk to you about it. And thank you for listening, reminding them you are my listener. You are my boss, but you are also here as a partner with me.
Yeah. And if we can remember as we do that, that there is never anything linear about the experience, right? We want to just kind of ditch what we think we know about stages or processes and not make, you know, what I call a grief grenade or, you know, a day that feels more emotional than the one before it mean anything. Right? That's just grief. We're not regressing. We're not going backward. We're not, you know, stuck. Like none of that has to be true. We're humans with emotions. And when we have grief, we they're not always predictable, right? And it's not nice and tidy. And it doesn't have to mean anything dramatic. But if we know that going in, then we can kind of have our own back. And then to your point about communicating to other people, it's easier to communicate when you're not judging yourself for how you're responding to your experience. Then you can be a better advocate for what your experience is,
what
like
you need,
kind of support that you need.
Yeah. And so on the reverse, and I'm particularly talking about work, let's say that you're a leader, and I just thought of sort of like random scenario 101 where, you know, I do have this opportunity. I would love to give it to her, but I don't know if she's ready and I don't want to put that burden on her. And I think she'll say yes if I offer it to her, but I don't want to do that. And so I don't really, in general, I guess what I'm getting at is I don't know how to interact with her, right? I don't know what to say. I want to say something, but I don't know what to say. On the other side, being the person who knows about somebody on their team who is struggling in any capacity or feeling challenged, what can we do to help them, to support them, to communicate with them?
I remember how in the beginning, it seemed like no one wanted to talk about what had happened. I mean, there was like initially they did right when I came back. But then when I kind of got back in the rhythm, you know, things would come up in meetings and it would be the perfect moment to mention Hugo, right? Because there would be like a
because they all know him.
Because they all knew him. And but there was a lot of hesitation. And I really understand that because I remember what, you know, was been like before I had my own significant loss, where you worry that I'm going to make it worse or they're not thinking about it. And they look like they're doing good. So I'm going to remind them, right? But usually the opposite is what the person in grief wants. They really usually want you to talk about their person. They are thinking about it. Mm-hmm. So it's actually kind of lonely when it feels like other people aren't. So I think if we could just remind ourselves that they are thinking about it, and if we bring it up, it's probably not going to remind them of something they have forgotten about. They might actually feel comforted that we also are thinking about it and caring for them, right? You know, again, there's no universal ways that we can do it and everyone will have the same response, but I just finally had to start telling stories about Hugo. Right. I just had to start bringing it up.
And then when I brought it up, it gave them permission
to do it. And then it was, you know, Hugo jokes left and right. And that was really,
comforting. Were there any surprises in your journey? It could be even something more recent where maybe you were surprised yourself or somebody else surprised you in the way they interacted with you.
Oh, well, there's a lot of surprises in the way people interacted with me, you know, just because you kind of have in mind that the people you maybe talk the most with or spend the most time with or perceive as close people to you will be the ones that come and support you. And I found that to not be necessarily true. Some of my biggest supporters were people I really didn't have close relationships with before Hugo died. And I mean, so some people just came out of the woodwork and I would have never anticipated that. And then other people who I thought would have been right there with me kind of disappeared. And I do think that's pretty universal. Most widows that I talk to have had that experience. Also, I think because I really thought all I ever knew was the five stages. I really thought, okay, there's a right way to do this. You know, I was kind of like the A player, always on the high performer list.
Oh yeah. Like, you might have to tell us what those are and then, yeah, so, then debunk them.
Totally. So the five stages of grief was something created by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and David Kessler. And it's the only grief culture that seems to be in our pop culture. Really, it's the one that shows up in all the movies. But basically, you're going to go through a stage of denial, then you're going to be angry, then you're going to bargain, and then you're going to get depressed, and then you're going to accept. Those are the five stages. Mm-hmm. And in its time, that work was really important because it started conversations that weren't happening. Mm-hmm. But it's important to know that that original work came from a study on hospice patients. It was not related to the experience someone has when they experience grief about a loss out, you know, a loss.
Oh, it came from the patient who was dying, their experience of dying.
Exactly. Yes. Uh-huh, and it was anecdotal. And again, very valuable in its time. But then that experience was then applied to on grief and grieving, right? So at first it was on death and dying, and then it was applied to on grief and grieving. Even Elizabeth Kubler-Ross in her later years really regretted how people took her work and turned it into some sort of linear, exacting process when that really wasn't what it was ever meant to be. So if that's what you think grief is, which is what I thought, I'm like, okay, am I angry enough? Mm-hmm. Is this the part where should I be angrier? Mm-hmm. Am I in denial? Like, and then I also thought acceptance then, because it was the last stage, would be this place I would reach, like a finish line. And then I would kind of be done, which is not at all how grief works, right? We're never done with it. We never move on from it. We integrate it into our lives. We learn how to think on purpose about the loss and who we want to be as, you know, as the person that the loss happened to, but it doesn't ever go away. Mm-hmm. And so I think that surprised me. I also bought into the myth that time heals. I had heard so much talk about year one. And so many people told me, just get through the first year. The first year is the worst. If you can just hang on or just stay busy, right? As though like something magical would happen at the end of year one, right? Mm-hmm. And then it didn't. So I got through the first death anniversary and I think I thought, okay, well, I've survived. Now it gets easier. Surprise. Mm-hmm. You know, you're still you. You still have the same thoughts and feelings. You still have emotions. You're still human. Mm-hmm. Nothing magical happens. So yeah, I wish I had known those things ahead of time.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything else we haven't touched on today that you'd like to share with us?
I am a big fan of post-traumatic growth. However, is that something that you talk about at all?
No, I don't. I was like,
okay. You're looking like, at me funny.
I heard, I'm a big fan of post-traumatic, and you know, and of course I went to stress disorder or whatever. And I was like, a big fan. What? It's like kind of similar to how this episode started, where it was like, I'm excited to talk about grief. But yeah, no, really I'm curious.
Post-traumatic growth. I remember the first time I heard it too. It was kind of like a record scratch. What? Like, what? You know, because everybody knows about post-traumatic stress disorder, but post-traumatic growth is much less talked about. So it's a phrase that was coined in the mid-90s by a couple of researchers, Tedeschi and Calhoun were their last names. And prior to their work, it was really thought that after something traumatic in nature, and again, trauma is subjective to the individual, but at the time it was kind of, we were in the big T, little T trauma, where we thought certain events were traumatic and other events were less so. But after something traumatic happened to a person, that, you know, most people would notice a dip in wellness in terms of quality of life. And before their work, it was thought that really the best thing that could happen, the goal, was to get that person back to the level of life satisfaction or wellness that they were experiencing before the trauma. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what these two researchers started to notice is that some people were actually not only getting back to the level of wellness or quality of life that they had experienced before, they were bouncing back, but there was this other group of people who were bouncing forward. They were reporting higher levels of satisfaction with life. And it wasn't actually in spite of what they had been through. They were reporting higher satisfactions in areas of life because of what they had went through, right? Like they had used that experience as a springboard to live life that is more aligned with what they value, to make it more of what they want
Right.
So it's not a should, mm-hmm. right? Post-traumatic growth. It's not morally superior. It's not something we want to put on the to-do list, but I wish I had known that then.
Yeah.
That you really can take anything you've been through and decide who you want to be in that and then adjust your life accordingly. And the analogy that I like to use is, because I live in Kansas, so we have tornadoes here, is like if a tornado comes and knocks down your house, you're going to build a new house, right? Mm-hmm. You could build a house that's as close as possible to the one that you had before. That wouldn't be right or wrong. That's just a choice you get to make. But if you've lived in that house for a while, which you have, you probably learned some things that maybe you would like to do differently when you build mm-hmm. your next house. Mm-hmm. And so you can redesign your house and build something else. And if you do that, it doesn't mean you didn't love your old house, right? It's not a commentary on the house you lived in. It's just saying, okay, I'm a human on the planet. In the first years or before this traumatic event, you know, this is what I thought. Now, this is what I think. This is what I want.
Yeah. Right. I love that.
And then we go.
I can't help but think about, you know, the women that I work the closest with, you know, with my one-on-one coaching and kind of see every single week. The roller coaster is ridiculous, like in terms of getting laid off and the situations or the things that are said to them, like in a traumatic way, right? You know, and then the growth on the other side is ridiculous, like off the charts, right? Yeah. And I think so many people think that in terms of career development, career growth, that it also has that linear way where we're going to figure this out. We're going to find the solution in the next job. But if we really know that there are all these ups and downs and different things that are going to happen to us, and then we're going to shift along the way and who we become is the most important thing, then it kind of just makes that flow. It doesn't feel like the jarring roller coaster. It's more like this flow. It's like this ebb and flow and come and go. And
you always get to be the boss of, you can't control what happens to you for sure.
Right.
But you do get to decide, okay, what do I want to do with this? You mm-hmm. know? And so, you know, for me, that looked like, I don't want to be in that job anymore. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with it, but I want to do something that makes an impact on the world. And so mm-hmm. I changed something, right? Mm-hmm. I saw a lot of relationships that I was having that were kind of surface level, mm-hmm. right? People I was just keeping in touch with because I did. But are those the people I want to have as my friends, or do I want to invest energy in different friendships? Mm-hmm. Right. So mm-hmm. it's recognizing that we have a choice and using that kind of traumatic moment sometimes as the opportunity to shake ourselves up a little bit and mm-hmm. go, whoa, okay.
That's not what I wanted.
Is this
anyway.
What I want?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Or what do I want so next? That mm-hmm. maybe that was what I wanted, but it's no longer mm-hmm. available to me. What do I want next?
Yeah. Yeah. Any final words of advice for our listeners? Anything else that you'd like to share with them as they go on their own journey, either as the person experiencing grief or wanting to be a more empathetic leader and connect with their team and other people at their company?
Yeah, grief's going to happen to all of us. It probably already has, right? But if the next time it happens to you or someone you love or someone you're leading, if you can remember that feelings aren't problems to solve, mm-hmm. right? They're just experiences to allow. I think that will make it a lot easier, because that really is the bulk of grief. It's just allowing mm-hmm. the feelings to flow through. Right. Mm-hmm. And if we could do that, that would be amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. That also goes with parenting. I think about that a lot.
Our kids' problems.
My kids' discomfort. Yeah, exactly. It's so good. Oh, thank you so much for that. Such good perspective. So tell us how people can connect with you. I think you have a podcast as well.
It's called The Widowed Mom Podcast. Don't let that scare you. If you want to learn more about grief, you can come hang out and listen to The Widowed Mom Podcast. Also, if you know someone who is a widowed mom, you know, please mm-hmm. tell them about the podcast. Coachingwithkrista.com is where you can find me online. And I also just created a quiz. So if somebody's out there wondering if they are stuck in a grief plateau and looking for resources around mm-hmm. that, I just created a free quiz and you can take it at coachingwithkrista.com/grief-plateau-quiz. And just in 2 minutes, you will learn whether or not you are in that plateaued place and then what to do about it.
Wonderful. Oh, thank you, Krista. Thank you for your heart and generosity. I so appreciate your story and, you know, just being willing to come on here and to connect with me. And also, kudos to you for reaching out to other platforms that aren't traditional grief platforms, because this message does need to be shared. And I'm glad that we were able to connect today.
Well, thanks for being willing, Stacey. I'm really glad to be here.
Before you go, I have a question for you. Do you know how close you are to your next promotion? Really? Not what your boss has told you, not what you even believe to be true, but have you actually taken the time to sit down, take an assessment, review the 5 categories that it takes to get promoted into senior executive leadership positions, and decided where you fall in each category, and given yourself a ranking on a scale of 1 to 10 of how close you are to getting your next promotion? Have you done this? Well, now's your chance. If that feels interesting to you and you're like, hey, I want to know exactly how close I might actually be, or how far away you might be, and what it's going to take to get you even closer, then I invite you to take my promotability quiz. This is a quiz that I put together with practical tips that actually tell you where you're lacking and where you're winning. What are the areas that you actually need to improve, and not necessarily what your boss is telling you all the time, so that you can take concrete steps towards landing that next promotion and changing the face of the leadership table. Go to yourpromotabilityscore.com to take your free assessment today. Yourpromotabilityscore.com, and let me know how it goes.